Hello, everybody, and welcome to Inside Education, the program and podcast for teachers, policymakers, researchers, and anyone with a stake in the future of teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can download podcasts of previous editions by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. David Dido is a former teacher who currently works as a writer, blogger, speaker, and trainer on several aspects of education. On last week's programme, I spoke to David about who he trusts on questions about education, about the lack of evidence behind learning styles and educational outcomes, and about the implications of the choices teachers make about teaching. One of the chapters in David Dido's book, What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong, is titled, You Can Prove Anything with Evidence. If that is true, I asked David, how can teachers evaluate research?
Honestly, teachers can't really evaluate research in a meaningful way. What teachers can do...
They can't or shouldn't?
No, they can't. What you can't do as a teacher is to read some research, look at a programme, a strategy, a methodology, and believe that you can objectively evaluate that effectiveness in your classroom. You can't do that because, you know, you're subject to all sorts of biases. And you're not randomising. Your sample size is negligible. What it does do, though, what teachers thinking with that kind of mindset, what it enables them to do is to say, right, in my classroom, in my limited, narrow experience, this sort of approach seems to be effective. Now, I'm also looking at the qualitative research, which also agrees that this sort of research is effective, and therefore I'm going to triangulate and say, you know, that looks pretty solid to me. What might happen is, okay, here's a piece of research which has got great numbers behind it. It's a gold standard randomized controlled trial. It's a meta-analysis that shows X. I'm going to try it honestly and openly in my classroom, and I just don't find it's effective. Well, okay, I think that craft knowledge that comes from having tried something and you can't get it to work, that's useful data. That doesn't prove anything for anybody else, but it's useful for you as an individual teacher. What I think is the worst case scenario is where there's a significant amount of research which says, look, we should be really cautious about this. And a teacher then goes, yeah, but it works for me. That I'm really, really sceptical of, because, well, how do you know it works for you? What are you saying? What are you basing that on? Often it's just on things like, well, my kids seem to like it. I get good results, so I'm not going to listen to anyone who tells me that, you know, they couldn't be better. There's a dangerous arrogance to that. I think we should be guided by the best quality research that we can find. You know, we should take that as a signpost, and then we should try and evaluate it and test it and run with it in our classroom. And if we get poor results, okay, leave off. Go back to what you were doing before.
You have a substantial section in your book on feedback, and you provocatively suggest that less may be more.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that idea?
Yeah. Feedback is one of these things that we've been encouraged to uncritically accept as being an obviously good thing. The kind of slightly precarious news is that in a lot of the meta-analyses done on the effects of feedback, actually quite a lot of the feedback that's given results in negative effects, that people actually do worse than if they were given no feedback at all. And that so some feedback seems to be a problem. Now, a lot of the education researchers out there makes these sort of headline claims, like, so the EEF, the Education Endowment Foundation, suggests on their toolkit that feedback results in an additional 8 months worth of instructional value. So for every year of teaching, you get an additional 8 months worth of value. Anyone who thinks that's true just hasn't thought about it, because I've never met a teacher that doesn't give feedback. So everyone's already giving feedback. You can't go to a teacher and say, if you do feedback, you'll get an additional 8 months. It's just not true. So it's what you're doing here. You could be doing it really badly. You could be making things worse. Let's go in and have a think about it in a bit more detail. It turns out, or at least there's good reason to think, that for students who are doing well, for who are meeting expectations, the only useful piece of feedback is feedback which leads to them raising their aspirations. Anything else is likely to be either neutral or negative. So, for instance, I've taught children where they've done well and I've given them some feedback, and what they've concluded is that they can get the same results and put in a lot less effort. Now, that's not disastrous, but it's a waste of my time. More importantly, though, are children who aren't getting where we need them to be. Now, the only type of feedback that's likely to be positive with those sorts of children is feedback that results in them believing that if they increase their effort, they'll see an improvement. If they don't believe that, then the feedback is likely to have a negative result. So it's likely to lead to them to saying things like, I'll just aim a bit lower, or I'll give up, I'm just rubbish at this, I'd rather not try than look stupid. And I've had that experience with many students, you know, unwittingly, but that's been the result of my well-intentioned, carefully crafted feedback. And it seems to be that it's utterly irrelevant how you go about giving the feedback. All that matters is how children receive and understand it. And how you give feedback is effective depending on your knowledge of and relationship with the children that you teach. So I've taught people where I know a sort of raised eyebrow at the right time is really good feedback. You know, if I frown at them, they'll raise their game. Whereas other people, I know that I'm going to need to sort of, you know, have a real heart-to-heart and sort of, you know, make them believe in themselves and be a bit touchy-feely. And that's what they're going to need. If I mismatch those in the belief that there's a correct way or an optimal way of giving feedback, that just won't work. You've got to align it to the human being that you're dealing with.
You also seem to be influenced in your ideas on feedback by the work of Carol Dweck and mindsets.
I'm a mindset skeptic. I mean, I think there's a lot in mindset which is nice and obvious and unproblematic.
But I think this is the idea of the closed and the open mindset. Yeah. And if you have a closed mindset, that you have the idea that intelligence is fixed and can't be improved. Yeah. And that if it's an open mindset, that it can be developed, but that the feedback you give can...
Yeah, I mean, Carol Dweck's written about the effects of praise. And there seems to be good reason for believing that if you praise somebody's outcomes, if you say what you've done is really good and you're really good because of that, then that could lead to them not wanting to take risks and avoiding a scenario where they weren't likely to get that same sort of praise. And that seems plausible to me. What I think is more interesting is the idea that comes to me anyway via the work of Robert Bjerk, who's a cognitive psychologist at UCLA. He has summarised a lot of research which seems to suggest that if you delay, reduce and summarise feedback, that can be better than giving it immediately in a clear and transparent way. Now, that sounds kind of counterintuitive and probably contrary to a lot of teachers' lived experience, because there's no doubt that if you give, you know, so a child hands in, let's say a child hands in a piece of work and you mark it and you write a set of suggestions for how they could do it better, and then you give it back to them and then they do it better, then obviously you've seen an improvement. Now, what Bjork and the people that sort of work with him suggest is that there's a very important difference between learning and performance. And performance is anything that you can perceive of your senses in the here and now. And learning is something that happens inside your head. And their definition of learning includes retention, can you remember it? And transfer, can you do it somewhere else? And the problem, if you accept the definition of learning that Bjork offers, is that you can't see in the here and now whether somebody's going to remember something. You have to wait. And you can't tell here whether you can do something elsewhere. You've got to go there and check it out. So as a teacher in a classroom, you can't see learning. All you can see is someone's performance. When someone hands in an essay and you mark it and you see an improvement, what you're seeing is an improvement in performance. You don't know whether that improvement is going to be something that is retained or transferable. You don't know how durable or flexible that learning is. So there's no doubt that by giving immediate feedback, you improve performance. But what this work casts into doubt is whether that's robust. So the suggestion is, if you make it slightly difficult, more difficult to follow, and you have a longer delay, then that will lead to maybe a reduction in performance in the short term, but an improvement in something more durable and flexible over the longer term. And I've sort of tried to understand this by thinking about map reading. I'm a shocking map reader. I really struggle with maps. And when I've had to use them in a car, I'm the sort of person that has to, every now and again, get out the car, align the map with the road network to try and work out where I am. And because it's such hard work, I try and minimise the map use as much as I can and remember, you know, landmarks and all the rest of it, so that I don't have to use the map. Like most people, now I use a sat-nav. And a sat-nav is the perfect assessment for learning machine. It knows exactly where you are in your learning. You tell it what outcome you want, where you want to be, and it gives you immediate step-by-step, trial-by-trial feedback on exactly how good your progress is. You know, if you make a mistake, it immediately alerts you and it says, look, here's a solution, you can do this instead. And it's so efficient at getting you to your desired destination that the consequence for me is there's very little need for me to try and remember the route, because the feedback mechanism is so perfect. So because it's so good, I don't put as much effort into learning, whereas with the map, it's worth putting the effort into learning. Now, I wonder whether we've created a similar sort of situation in the classrooms, where children have a relationship with their teachers a bit like I have with my sat-nav, where they're so used to teachers saying, do it like this, here's the solution, because with the very best of intentions, we want them to do well. So we try and support that as far as possible, but maybe we're valuing their short-term performance at the cost of their long-term gains. And it leads to something which is sometimes called the illusion of knowledge. If I give you feedback that you've done something very well, what you remember is, oh yeah, I'm really good at that. And so very often we think we know things we don't actually know. You know, I had an experience of this where I went to see a lecture by a physicist, Brian Cox, poster boy of British physics, and he was giving a lecture on the quantum universe, and it was fascinating stuff, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I came back from the lecture sort of fizzing with sort of thoughts and ideas, and my wife said to me, she asked me about it, and I was saying, oh, it's brilliant, really, Brian Cox, what a guy. And she said, what did he say? I don't know, but it was really good. And it was that, what did he say, that exposed my ignorance. It was like I thought I understood something, that it became really, really clear that I didn't. And I think children have that you give them feedback and then they make a performance improvement and they think, oh, I'm really good at this. If you were to wait 3 weeks and give them an assessment, it might be revealed that they're not very good at it. And I think that if instead of giving them that kind of sat-nav feedback, which props up their performance in the here and now, if instead we offered them clues rather than solutions, incomplete advice rather than easy to follow instructions, then that would be harder, that would be more frustrating, that would be more difficult for children, but they're less likely to build up an illusion of knowledge. They're going to have a much more accurate understanding of their own ability.
Is that your main reservation about assessment for learning? Because that's something that I know you write a bit about in the book as well.
Yeah, kind of. I think people uncritically take feedback from assessment for learning in lessons about what children do and don't know. And because assessment for learning isn't assessing learning, it's assessing performance, it can lead to teachers believing that children can do things, have mastered things that actually they haven't. They've forgotten them. They can't do them anymore. So just to wrap up the thoughts on delaying feedback, what I wouldn't want a teacher listening to this to believe is that I've said they shouldn't give feedback. That would be a disaster. Of course you should give feedback. But what I think might be really useful is to think about why you're giving it. So at the beginning of a course, or when you first meet a class, if your purpose for giving feedback is to encode the idea of success, to build up children's mental representations of how to excel at this topic, and to get them to trust you and to build your relationship with them, then it makes really good sense to give sat-nav style feedback, really precise instructions on what great looks like, and really support them to do that. If you carry on doing that all the way through, that's unlikely to be effective after a certain point. So what I would suggest is that once you've encoded the idea of success, that you've built the relationship, that you've got some trust, then it becomes time to try and stop giving so much feedback, to make it slightly more difficult and less easy to follow, so that you're promoting memorization. It's like giving me an A to Z and saying, work out where you are. It's hard work, I don't want to do it. So it means I learn how to store the information in my head rather than rely on the map, which is a pain. Because if by the end of a course, if the feedback that you've been giving children, if it isn't in their heads, it was an utter waste of time giving it. If they haven't remembered it, if they don't know it, why did you bother? And so it needs delaying over time. Maybe at the beginning, that would be a disastrous time to delay it.
And does the kind of feedback matter? In other words, the kind of detail, I'm thinking of, do you give feedback on what the child has done, or do you give feedback on the mistakes that they've made, or on how they're working? Like, does that make a difference?
I don't know. I think that those sorts of things are dependent on what you're teaching and who you're teaching. I think there are times and places for giving feedback on all those things. It would be wrong for me to suggest that here's the right level of description to give, because there are so many variables. So I'd kind of suggest that my background is as an English teacher. So if I was teaching A-level sort of pre-university courses on, let's say, on a Shakespeare play, and I'm expecting children to write sort of extended essays on their understanding of motivations in Macbeth, then the type of feedback I'm going to give is very, very different to teaching sort of basic elements of grammar, because the level of detail is completely different. So I don't really know the answer to that. You know, that's where your professional judgment becomes really important. You know what you teach, and you know the children you're teaching, so you make a judgment armed with the best understanding of the research that's out there.
Given that you are critical of many aspects of education, you are, strangely to me, in favour of testing.
Right.
Why is that?
So testing's a really loaded word. So it's got so many sort of, it's a pejorative. Oh, you know, we think about testing as being cruel and making children cry. And so I think there's two sort of things to break down with the idea of testing. So firstly, let's deal with the idea of standardised testing, which has a really terrible reputation. Everyone hates standardised testing. And there's a large vocal body of opinion which says teacher assessment, portfolio assessment, is much fairer and more reasonable than standardised assessment. And actually that turns out not to be true. It's much less fair. That teachers are unwittingly subject to unconscious cognitive biases, which systematically have been shown with some quite large-scale research to show that children from ethnic minorities and disadvantaged backgrounds are further disadvantaged by teacher assessment. They do less well.
Is that by portfolio assessment?
By any kind of teacher assessment where you, as the teacher of the child, get to determine the grade of the child.
As opposed to standardised testing?
As opposed to standardised testing, which is anonymous, where there isn't any kind of relationship. And that's quite jarring to discover that anyone who goes into teaching is going into teaching for honourable reasons, and we all want children to do their very, very best. And the idea that I'm suggesting that teachers might be being biased against ethnic minorities or disadvantaged students is really unpleasant to hear. But it seems we're fairly helpless against this. No one does it on purpose, or maybe they do, but that's not the problem. The problem is that we're victim to things like the halo effect. We systematically believe that if children are well-spoken and smartly dressed, then they're also more academic, and we treat them differently. Standardised testing doesn't do that. So children from less privileged backgrounds do better where there's standardised testing. So I think that's really important to get out there, you know, whatever your objections to it might be. So if you're worried about standardised testing being less fair for children, I think that's probably not true. If you're worried about it having an adverse effect on children's mental health, then I think that's got perhaps more to say about you and your approach than it has with the testing itself. Tests don't make people anxious and lead to poor mental health. It's the stakes that we attach to them. And I think that because teachers are often under more pressure than students for students to do well, then we create a really toxic environment. So in England, at the end of Key Stage 2, so the upper primary going into secondary, there's SATS testing, where schools are held to account for how well children do in these SATS tests. The SATS tests themselves have absolutely no value for the children, but the environments within a lot of primary schools are so toxic, where children are being given these messages that, you know, if you don't do well in this test, then your life is ruined and you're stupid and everyone will hate you. You know, it's awful. We've got to stop doing that. But that's not the tests that do that. That's the weight to which we give them. They don't have to be used in that way and with that effect. So that's standardised testing. The other thing to pick up about testing is that I think it can be used very, very effectively as a pedagogical technique. We should use it much, much more formatively. And so if you rebrand testing and call it quizzing, it doesn't have nearly the same negative connotation. People go to pubs for quizzes for fun. You know, they watch quiz shows on TV. We like quizzes, we just don't like tests. And so if you quiz children on what they've learned, what they're able to do, then that doesn't seem nearly so threatening as giving them a test. The great effect of testing, or retrieval practice, as psychologists talk about it, is that it's a really great way of combating that illusion of knowledge, that often, you remember that the teacher taught you something, and you think, yeah, I can do this. And then they ask you a question, and you realise you can't. And you're like, oh, okay. So that's actually really useful feedback. I thought I knew something. It turns out I don't. Let's deal with that. Whereas if no one ever tests whether or not you actually can do what it is that you think you can do, then you might carry on with the sort of incorrect belief that you've learned something you haven't actually learned. So testing is great for that. The problem seems to be, again, about stakes. So if you as a teacher are setting up an environment in your classroom where there is negative consequences for doing poorly in these quizzes, then you're going to create an adverse environment. Even doing little things like tracking data, if you're recording how well everyone does in the quiz, then that's a stake. What's useful is that the child learns whether they do or don't know something, whether they can or can't do something. That's what it's for. And so I used to do this in lessons where I'd start a lesson by saying, okay, we're going to have 5 questions, one about last lesson, one about last week, one about last month, you know, and sort of track back. And I'd ask them these questions. And sometimes the children would say, oh, you've asked us this question before. And I'd say, great, what's the answer? And they go, don't know. You know, they recognise the question. They still couldn't answer it. And so this familiarity leads to an idea of an illusion of knowledge.
And you also write in your book that testing repeatedly can actually be a good thing.
Yeah. Well, when you say repeatedly, I mean, obviously not, you know, again and again and again in the same lesson. What I think is useful is saying or communicating to children, the stuff that I'm teaching you is of such value and importance in my view that I'm going to continually be helping you to remember it and to check whether you can still do it, and not assume that we did it 2 years ago, it's not important anymore, but let's just dump it. And so by constantly quizzing them on stuff that they think is in the past, you're helping them to sort of cement that and have it more firmly fixed in their long-term memory.
Another idea in education that's regarded very highly is differentiation, but you refer to it as a dark art. Why is that?
I mean, differentiation is one of those things where it's obviously a good thing to treat children differently, and anyone who says that's not a good thing is obviously wrong. But the way in which that's been interpreted in my experience in a lot of the schools I've worked in and worked with, it's been interpreted in some really silly ways. So one of the ideas has been that within your lesson, you've got to essentially have a completely different lesson plan for every single child in the lesson. And they all have to do work which is somehow expertly tailored to exactly their needs. And the amount of work that would create for a teacher makes it so obviously unsustainable that nobody could ever get that to work. Even if that was a good thing to do, it would kill teachers. So that, I think, is something we should get rid of straight away. Another practice that I've seen quite a lot of is where teachers are expected to have lessons with differentiated outcomes, where they sort of communicate at the start of the lesson, everyone's got to achieve this. Some of you might get to this stage, and a few of you might go on to achieve. And I think that sends some really unfortunate messages to kids that, you know, some of you don't need to, just, you can settle. for the least challenging. And I remember once watching a lesson, and I was sitting next on this table with these lads. The outcome of the lesson was differentiated as almost some. So all must do this, most must do this, some might do this. And one lad turned to his partner and said, I think I'm just going to be most today. He'd learned how to play a game. And so again, you know, that's something that I think is poor. Now, interestingly, as a sort of data point, the most recent PISA tests did something quite interesting. They looked at student perceptions of their teaching, and they asked them a series of questions, which they had to strongly agree, strongly disagree with. And one of the areas of questions they were asked about was the extent to which teachers adapted instruction depending on their needs. PISA refers to this as the index of adaptive instruction. And it turns out adaptive instruction is one of the most positively correlated aspects of education with test results. And so that's worth looking at. Well, what's that then? And so it turns out that adaptive instruction is teachers going, okay, does anyone not understand this? Right, okay, let's explain it again. Obviously, you know, anyone who says you shouldn't do that is crazy, you know, that you plough on regardless whether or not the kids have kind of got it, that you adapt your instruction depending on, you know, where the class in front of you actually is as opposed to where you'd like them to be. You know, that's just basic good teaching. So if differentiation means adaptive instruction, I'm all for it, definitely. But what I'm against is the kind of guilt and shame that teachers feel for not creating sort of 7 different lesson plans for each lesson and thinking that they're somehow failing their students by not doing that. I just think that's nonsense. And the sooner and the further that we get away from that, the better.
And that reflection from David Dido on the distinction between differentiation and adaptive instruction brings this week's Inside Education to a close. David Dido is the author of What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? To download previous editions of Inside Education podcasts, including last week's interview with David Dido, go to seandelaney.com. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and from local libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.